Talking Bollocks, a Go Loud original podcast. Sponsored by Right Style Furniture. Right price, right style, right now. Visit rightstyle.ie.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Are you still sitting on a beanbag in your sitting room like you're 17?
Grow up and head to Right Style Furniture. They've got proper, comfy, stylish gear and they're Irish and family run too.
The house packages are class. For just €3,649, you get an electric sofa set, full dining setup, and beds with mattresses. That's a serious bang for your buck.
I got my corner sofa off them, and I haven't stood up since.
They've got locations in Font Hill, Belgard, and now Omni Park, open every day and late on a Thursday and Friday in Font Hill and Omni.
One-stop shop for kitting out the gaff. Don't say we never looked after you.
Exactly. Right price, right style, right now.
Visit www.rightstyle.ie. And when you shop in store, tell them Terence and Calvin sent you, and they'll throw a discount on top of that as well. So get down to Right Style Furniture today.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your weight in the crowd. Fill your body up. Walk it hard and low. When you finish that,
the hip knocker.
Go down, go down, go down.
Episode 270 of the Talking Bollocks podcast, brought to you by Go Loud. It's me, COB.
It's me, Terry Flower.
And today we're joined by
Jeff Knopfer.
Jeff, you flew in this morning to have this conversation and do this podcast with us, and we really do appreciate it. Do you want to just give a slight intro into who you are and what your background is?
Yeah, sure. My name's Jeff Knopfer. I was a police officer in Greater Manchester area and also worked in London and elsewhere. Really, the reason I'm here today is because I got involved in reinvestigating the Moors murders in the 1980s. Brady and Hindley committed these appalling murders with young children. The victims were young children in the 1960s, and they were both sentenced to life imprisonment. The case was reopened in the 1980s because there were two missing children still unaccounted for. In 2004, I got a call from the Department of Justice in Dublin asking if I'd come over and talk to them about the Commission for the Disappeared. I was aware of it, but I didn't know a great deal about it. I came over, and then in 2005, I was requested by the Irish government and the Northern Ireland UK government to undertake a review of what had happened since the Good Friday Agreement and see what opportunities were still remaining to do some work. I think the most important aspect of all this is that, you know, this is a humanitarian process, yeah, and not a criminal investigation process, yeah, albeit most of us were ex-detectives, and bizarrely from the other side of the water. And it seemed strange that we should be coming in to do this work. But I remember people saying, well, you're coming over and doing this, you don't come with any baggage, you know. So they kind of got on with us because we were outsiders, I suppose, and they knew that we weren't aligned to any factions, any, yeah, political organisations, yeah, or anything else. So we were outsiders, and it worked very well.
Yeah, you didn't have a team or a side.
That's right.
Yeah.
We didn't have our own agendas.
Yeah.
So, Jeff, take us back to the start for you. Did somebody have an influence on you to go into that line of work when you were a young child, or did you ever imagine you'd take that career?
Well, oddly enough, not really. When I left college, I joined the family business, which was watchmakers and jewellers. My dad was a watchmaker and very well respected within the profession. He died when I was just a teenager, and I guess I got a little bit disillusioned by all this. And I had a friend who joined the police and listened to some of the stories he was telling me. And I got interested in it, and really on a whim became a police officer, and thought that I would probably be a constable, you know, or a guard equivalent,
yeah,
for the rest of my career. And to my astonishment, things worked out okay.
So where did you grow up?
In Manchester. I don't know whether you're aware of it. There's the town next door to Manchester, the city next door to Manchester, is Salford.
Salford, yeah,
that was,
course,
that,
yeah,
was my hometown, very much Northern England.
Yeah, and what was that area like?
Well, it was a heavily industrialised area. There were very few green spaces. I can always remember my dad was involved in scouting. He was a commissioner in the scout movement, and I can remember going out with him, because he was an elderly man by that time. I think I was very much an afterthought. you know, sitting there around a campfire, having mugs of tea with him, and thinking, God, this is what green looks like, you know. But as the years went by, you realise there's more to it than that.
How did you go on in school then, Jeff?
Didn't do great. Didn't like school particularly. But when I joined the police, I went on a course and I was granted a scholarship to go to university. Oi. So that's really how things changed for me. I went to university and then got a first degree and then did a master's degree after that off my own bat, part-time, and various other qualifications over the years. So, yeah, I think university was an afterthought in those days. But I'm very, very grateful to the police for kind of educating me, I suppose.
Mm. Yeah. What did you study?
Politics and history in the early days, and then forensic science later.
Yeah. So that definitely stood to you then later on down the, down the line, yeah?
Yes, it did. Albeit, I have to say, you know, when I came to Ireland in 2005, it was, by any stretch, it was a steep learning curve. Yeah. There's no two ways about that.
Yeah.
You know, they were clearly difficult times, and albeit I'd studied history, I wasn't aware of just how dire things were pre-1968, 69, you know.
Mm. Yeah. When you joined the police force, are you just out on the beat and you're happy to do that?
Yeah, I was 4 years, something like that, out on the streets doing shift work. Early days, obviously, pounding the beat on foot. As years went by, panda cars came along and we were all driving around, which I think was probably a great mistake for policing, really, because we lost that touch with the communities.
So you're out on the beat for 4 years, you said.
Yeah.
Then you go on to become a detective.
Yes, yeah.
So one of the, I suppose, infamous cases that you worked on would have been the Moore murders. Can you tell us a bit of background about what actually happened there and then how you got involved in it?
This was a couple, Ian Brady and Mara Hindley, who had been working together in the early 60s. They met at their place of work, a firm called Millward's Merchandising. She was a young typist, never been in trouble at all. Brady was born in Glasgow and had spent his early days up there and got himself in a bit of hot water here and there with theft and the like. And one of the court appearances that he made, the judge said, right, well, your mother has moved. She'd met somebody and moved down to Manchester. And he said, right, you can go and live with your mother down in Manchester. So that's how he moved from Glasgow to Manchester. Of course, these two, as I say, they were working in the same place. He studiously ignored her for months on end. She thought he was just this most wonderful guy. I mean, he was one of the few guys there who wore a collar and tie, you know. He was a clerk there, I think, in the sort of accounts department. And, of course, he was just very aloof with her the whole time. And then the fateful Christmas party. And, of course, they met at the Christmas party and the rest is history. He had serious psychological problems. There's no two ways about that. Personality disorder, and he was a schizophrenic as well. And he persuaded her that abducting kids and murdering them was okay. I mean, it's hard to even think, you know.
How do you get somebody to do
that?
Yeah.
But she did. And, you know, I've often been asked, well, what would have happened to her if she'd not met Ian Brady? Well, I think she'd probably have just got married and had a family and gone on with life. But a psychiatrist once told me, I was kind of politely told off by this guy, and he said, well, you know, she must have had the predisposition to take this sort of stuff on. And I suppose that you can't argue with that, really. It's true. Mm. But it's horrific. I mean, it's absolutely horrific.
Yeah.
And she always said that she wasn't physically involved in the murders of these children. She was certainly physically involved in the
abduction.
In the abductions. Yeah. She was clearly guilty of procuring these victims for him, and therefore she was just as guilty as he was, and she was. Mm.
Hmm. They had initially been sentenced to life in prison for the murders of three kids, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah.
And they were suspected of committing five murders now in total. So
two more. Outstanding.
How did they get convicted on the first three?
It's a really long story, but their brother-in-law, a guy called David Smith, who's now dead, so we can talk about this more openly, he had a rather dodgy background too, and he got friendly with Ian Brady. And they abducted a young lad called Edward Evans from a railway station in Manchester and took him back to their house and murdered him there. And Smith was present during this event. And he came out. He was married to Mara Hindley's sister, Maureen. He came out and went home. And I presume completely shell-shocked by what he'd seen, because Brady beat this kid to death. And between him and his wife, they decided they were going to call the police, because I think it dawned on Smith very quickly that he was probably the next victim because he knew too much. So they went to a call box in the middle of the night and phoned the police. The police went to the house the next morning and they obviously arrested Brady straight away because they knew Brady had committed the murder. And they found the body in Mara Hindley's bedroom, all trussed up and hidden in plastic sheeting. And she was arrested shortly afterwards.
And then they were able just to piece together?
Yeah, there were... He was an avid photographer and he used to process his own black and white photographs. And they found photographic evidence of the cases, the victims. They'd left two suitcases in a left luggage department in a railway station. When those were recovered, they had photographs of the victims and they also had a tape recording of what was purported in the trial in the 1960s to be the murder of one of the little girls, a 10-year-old girl. She was always adamant when we spoke to her, because they wouldn't talk about this, of course, in the 1960s. By the 1980s, she was saying, well, it wasn't actually a recording of the murder, but it was certainly a recording of the photographic session that he took. And she claimed that she didn't know the tape recorder was there, that it was hidden under the bed, and she wasn't told. Mm. Who knows?
What happened in the 80s that their Mars Murders case was reopened?
It started because a journalist, a guy called Fred Harrison, who worked for the Today newspaper, which is now long, long gone, he managed to wheedle his way into prison to see Ian Brady. And he pretended that he was there as a sort of freelance social worker and he wanted to help Brady. In actual fact, he was a professional journalist. And he carried this on for some considerable time and then went in and told Brady that he was a journalist, and that blew it. But of course, the next day, the headline in the Today newspaper was that Brady admits two more cases. Well, he hadn't admitted two more cases. He just not said he hadn't done them. So that was good enough for a tabloid newspaper, of course, you know. Mm.
So this all kind of resurfaces then in 1986, you said, because they have this somewhat confession of the two killings.
Yeah.
What are murders?
Yeah, it's quite difficult to figure out why it all happened the way it did, I suppose. We did a lot of background work on Mara Hindley.
Yeah.
Brady was by this time in a psychiatric hospital and classified in lay terms as being mad as a hatter. She isn't, and she's in obviously doing a full life term in a female prison. But everybody we spoke to, from prison officers present and past and fellow inmates past, said that you won't get anywhere with her. She's highly intelligent, which she was, and she's very manipulative. You know, she won't give you the time of day. So Peter Topping, my boss at the time, and I went down to a place called Cookenwood Prison in Kent. The only person who knew where we were going was the prison governor. He couldn't tell anybody because it would leak. Mm. So we knocked on the door and said, could we speak to the prison governor, please? He came down, obviously knew who we were, and we went in and spoke to Mara Hindley, and she straight away, she said, in coded terms, I'm prepared to help. She said that she was prepared to point out areas that were of interest to Ian Brady on this piece of moorland.
Did you try and speak to Brady, though?
Yeah, we did several times.
Sorry, you did speak to him, or you tried to speak to him?
We spoke to her first.
Yeah.
We'd taken advice from, as I say, it's a long, convoluted tale, but long story short, we'd taken advice from psychiatrists who said that this guy could well be on the brink of, you know, teetering on the brink of spilling the beans. And if you can apply pressure to him, he might actually tell you what happened. We hadn't really contemplated her because of this background we'd been told about her being very manipulative and want to give you the time of day. We hadn't realised that was an avenue we could explore.
Mm.
So we were very shocked when we went in and she said, yeah, what do you want to know, basically? And we'd set up a press briefing outside the prison on the assumption that she wouldn't tell us anything, when in fact she did. So we wanted to cancel the briefing, but of course we couldn't because it was all there. So national television was out there with the cameras rolling when we got out, and we had to say that, you know, Mara Hindley's been very helpful. The idea was to put pressure on Brady. This was all done in October, November. We were going to leave any physical searching to the following year, so it left months for him thinking that we knew something that we didn't know. Yeah. But actually, it didn't work out like that.
Was that the first big case that you walked on, Jeff?
No, I'd worked on murder cases before that, but I think that was the first case where, you know, it was a notable case. I mean,
so much
all murders, all murders are notable cases, locally and regionally, perhaps. But that was a nationally, you know, I mean, it was one of the biggest cases in the UK at the time. In 1986 was the review of the Moors murders.
Is it more difficult to work on a case that has so much attention around it?
Well, I think it is because there's media interest and you're always in the spotlight, or the case is in the spotlight, not you as an individual, but the investigation is in the spotlight. So we were very, very much under the spotlight with the Moors, particularly the searching of Saddleworth Moor for the children. I can always remember it, the local newspaper, the evening before, it was in July 1986, there was an editorial in the evening newspaper and it said, "Stop this farce now." And the next day, we found Pauline Reed. And of course, this newspaper had to eat very humble pie thereafter. But it was just the way it went. But those were the sort of pressures that we were under at the time. Very difficult.
What's it like when you're sitting there and you're interviewing her or him in that scenario, and you know, can you sense the evil of them? Or do you have to kind of park that?
Well, I think with a guy like him, clearly, we had proof that he had done all this stuff. I mean, she'd told us by that time as well what he'd done and what she'd done. Yeah, I mean, he was just an evil, evil character, but he was mad as a hatter as well, you know, and trying to manipulate everything, trying to manage everything for the greater glory of Ian Brady. Very, very difficult character to deal with. And when we finally interviewed him, you know, her interview, which was all tape recorded, of course, took 3 days. His took about 10 minutes because he just said, "Yes, I did it." You know, that was about the sum total. "Yes, I did all this. I did murder this. I did murder this one. I did murder this one." And that was it.
And what did they actually say to help you find the remains then?
She was very, very helpful. She was very good. We had a situation whereby, a facility, should I say, whereby we could go back to the office in the evenings and talk to her on the phone. She was absolutely on board with this. And, you know, I've been asked dozens of times over the years why you would think that was the case. You know, what was it all about? I mean, she probably would have said, "Well, this was because I felt sorry for what I'd done. It was just remorse and what have you." I think we were more minded to think it was a ploy to get out of prison 10 years on. You know, if she'd done another 10 years, and there was no doubt about it. They were looking, her advisors were looking to take this to the European courts with a view to getting her released, because I think she was the longest serving female prisoner in the UK at the time, you know. Mm.
Is it not true that she received a letter, though, from one of the victim's mothers?
She did. She did. Again, it's quite difficult because this lady was manipulated by the tabloid press, tabloid journalists, and they were writing these letters for her. But you're absolutely right. I think it was a coincidence that this letter arrived at around the time that we had arranged to see her. Mm. I guess a chicken and egg thing. You know, she said straight away that she'd had this letter, she'd received this letter, and it had impressed her, or it had concerned her in some way, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was coincidence. We didn't know about the letter beforehand. So
what happens next then? She gives you, because I presumed the Moors had been searched high and low at the time and they couldn't find them. So what happens differently this time?
These two children who were missing hadn't been searched for at that time, Pauline Reed and Keith Bennett. They hadn't been searched for in the 1960s. They hadn't been linked formally with the investigation in the 1960s. And that was part of the review that I was tasked with doing before we started. You know, were they involved in these two cases? And clearly, you know, I mean, obviously you haven't got cast iron proof at that stage, but the circumstances were such that it looked very, very much like, you know, there were similarities all the way through. So we were satisfied that they were linked cases. Really, it was at that stage that we said, right, well, we need to go and see her and see where we go. And we fully expected to get nowhere. And, well, I've told you already that when we got there, we found that she was amenable. And she started out by saying, "I'm prepared to show you areas of Saddleworth Moor," which is where all these kids were buried, "that were of interest to Ian Brady or of relevance to Ian Brady," without saying, "I know where the bodies are." But that was, you know, her way of saying, "I'll point you in the right direction." thank goodness we had come up with, remarkably, those two areas, those two locations, from the historical evidence that we'd seen. We thought those two areas were of interest too. So that's where we were concentrating our work. And then as the months went by, of course, she eventually decided to make a full confession with her lawyer present, had a priest present as well, an Anglican priest, and she spilled the beans lock, stock and barrel. I mean, absolutely, chapter and verse about what had happened. It was always a case of I was never physically there. I was always watching out, or I was drawing a bath of water, or I was doing this. You know, I was never physically there standing in front of him murdering a child.
Mm. Yeah. What level of detail did she give you then to help locate the bodies?
You know, I mean, talk about history repeating itself. You look at what happened then and what happened in Northern Ireland, or obviously in Ireland more generally, because this is all around the borders, or a lot of it is around the borders. You know, people's memories play tricks, ground changes, land changes. I can always remember talking to somebody about a case here, and I said to this guy, so how far do you think the grave was from the tree line? Because there's a forest there now. And he said, what tree line? It didn't exist then. And it just concentrates the mind, you know, that things changed. Things changed dramatically. And that was a difficulty with there, and a difficulty here, that, you know, you're talking about barren wastelands, bogland or moorland. There are no landmarks, and often these places are selected because there are no landmarks. You know, they're pretty anonymous. But fortuitously, on one occasion, we knew that the bodies had been buried in peat, and we were looking at a peat bog that was sitting on bedrock. So we were literally chipping into this peat outcrop from the bedrock, if you want, looking for Pauline Reed. We realised that at some areas on this outcrop, you could be seen from the road. So, of course, we asked the obvious question. We went back one evening and spoke to her and said, can you remember what time of the day, or what time of the evening this was? Because if it was still daylight, they couldn't have used this area because it could be seen from the road. And she said, well, it was just going dusk. And she said, I remember it was just going dusk because I looked across the valley and I could see this V-shape of two hills on the other side of the valley. And we didn't really give this a great deal of thought, but we went back the next day and there was only a limited area where you could actually physically see this V-shape that she talked about. And it just narrowed the search area down to, you know, 100 metres or two. I mean, it was just a fantastic, it was a chance question, a chance answer, and it found Pauline Reed. There's no two ways about that.
Gee, like, without that bit of detail there, how big was the area you were searching in general?
Oh, God, miles. It could have been miles, yeah. We had set ourselves targets, if you want, and we said, you know, we would search either side. Originally, we said we'd search either side of the road up to 300 or 400 metres, because they probably wouldn't have walked more than 100 or 2 metres, so we put an extra 100 metres on, you know, for safety. So those are the sort of distances we were looking at. We probably have found Pauline Reed looking at that 300 or 400 metre barrier. But the other kid, Keith Bennett, who was missing, he was walked onto the moor and walked half a mile onto the moor. So that wouldn't have, fortuitously, we had some indication of where he might have been. So because of some photographs that Brady had taken. Mm. So we were more sighted really on that. So we didn't just use that 300 metre limit. Mm. We also wanted to search this valley that, and he was buried in this valley, and sadly has we've not found him. I think this is not easy to say, but I suspect criminal graves as a rule tend to be very shallow affairs. Brady's were certainly no exception. They were very shallow graves. And the moment this little boy became exposed, he was in the side of a gully, a peat gully. The moment that becomes exposed, you know, it's open to the elements and predation and what have you. So let's not go there.
Come up. so that's in the 80s. You then decided to retire from the police force in 97?
97, yeah.
Yeah. What's the plans there? Are you thinking, right, that's enough of that? I've done my time.
No, I was, for the last few years of my career, I'd been promoted, you know, fortuitously, over the years, and I ended up as a detective chief superintendent. And I was down in London working as an advisor, a police advisor at the Home Office. And so I'd commuted to London for the last few years, you know, down on a Monday and back on a Friday. So it was that in itself was a challenging way of life, I suppose. And then right out of the blue, because I was heavily involved in forensic science at the time and major crime investigation policy, I suppose, this job came up as a college dean at a police college looking at that sort of work. And that's really what made me
step away.
Yeah. So I had this rather grandiose title of dean, you know, college dean.
So what are we talking there? You're talking like late 90s, early 2000s?
Yeah, that was in 97. And then I started doing a little bit of consultancy work. And right out of the blue, I got a call from the Department of Justice saying, we understand you're good at finding dead bodies. Will you, can you come over and talk to us? And I did, and the rest is history, I suppose.
So, Jeff, you are brought over to Ireland then and tasked with finding the missing people from, they were labelled the disappeared. Do you want to give us a background on who they were or what the task at hand was?
Sure. The disappeared, it's predominantly a Republican paramilitary issue, more so than a loyalist paramilitary issue. I'm not saying categorically that there are no loyalist cases, but the ones that are well known are certainly the Republican ones. And both the Provisional IRA and the INLA were involved in this sort of stuff. This was predominantly about informers, you know, shooting people who they believed were informers, and concealing the bodies. The earliest cases that the Commission's dealing with, were, I think 1972 is the absolute earliest. In those later times, from mid-80s onwards, that reduces dramatically. And where people are, to use their term, executed, they would be left on the roadside. The bodies would be left on the roadside. So I think a lot of people thought that even former paramilitaries would say, well, you know, the consequences of touting is execution, and that's fine. But what they couldn't go along with was concealing the bodies and not telling anybody. And actually, when you think about it, it defeats the object, because the whole ethos of this is a deterrent.
Yeah.
You know, if you tout, we'll shoot you.
Yeah.
And if you're not going to tell anybody you've shot them and hidden the bodies, what is the point?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, common sense probably prevailed eventually, and they thought this wasn't getting anybody anywhere. Whether it was done because they were frightened of the forensic consequences or not, I'm not at all sure. If you look at the history of Ireland, you know, you can go back countless years, certainly to the beginning of the 20th century, you know, the Civil War period and the War of Independence period, when there were lots of people disappeared. So this wasn't something new in the 1960s and 70s and 80s, I suppose. It had happened before. And you could argue that that's probably where the Republican paramilitaries took their cue from, what had happened previously.
Things were really dire when you come over to Ireland.
Yeah.
How dire was it?
I think it was a bit of a culture shock. I mean, I'd been in the police and I knew what had been going on from 1968 to 1998.
Yeah.
But the depth of the conflict, I suppose, the despair of the families, particularly the families of the disappeared, it was horrifying, really.
Yeah.
And they'd been kept in the dark. You know, this thing had happened to their loved ones, but nobody had actually told them what had happened or why it had happened. And even to this day, I mean, there are some of those cases where the families have not the faintest clue why their loved ones were abducted and killed.
So this centres around 17 people, really, that disappeared.
Yeah, as the years have gone by, this figure of 17 has cropped up. There's a very interesting book on the disappeared by a guy called Padraig O'Rourke, who has done the history of the disappeared all the way back to the year dot. And he probably would correctly say there were more than 17. But I think those 17 or the others that he's talking about have been recovered over the years. So the commission was faced with a number of 17. So really what I'm trying to say is probably not the definitive list. but a reasonably accurate list. And of those 17, 13 have now been recovered. So there are 4 cases still outstanding. Just to qualify, the Good Friday Agreement, the 1998 Good Friday Agreement, was used as the cut-off date. So there have been cases of people being abducted and disappeared since, 1 or 2, and they are not included in that list. And the other important aspect of this is that this is about paramilitary activity. So where you've got criminal disappearances, they wouldn't necessarily fall within the auspices of the commission's cases.
When you got information, you weren't able to go to the police and they could use it as a murder investigation?
No. The commission was designed, I've got to say that the legislation that the two governments passed, two governments enacted, is absolutely inspired, because this is wholly and solely humanitarian. It's about helping the families, it's about recovering the victims and returning them to the families. Really, no questions asked. So this is not a criminal process, it's a humanitarian process. And any information that the commission comes by whatever means, is privileged. It can't be passed to the police, it can't be passed to anybody else, and it can't be used in a criminal prosecution.
It's an amnesty, so,
yeah. I think, you know, some people say, well, that's an amnesty. Well, perhaps not. It's a limited immunity more than an amnesty. I think amnesty is a politically loaded word. So I think immunity is fine. It is limited. And if the police do something separate from the commission, there's nothing stopping them investigating this as a murder case. It's just that the commission can't pass information to them.
Yeah.
And we can't hold evidence. So I think it comes as quite a shock to some people to say, well, you know, what would the commission do if it came across evidence? We would conceal it. We wouldn't disclose it to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we'd destroy it.
So you were contacted, I'd imagine... The reason why they contacted you is because they were having great difficulty finding them.
Yeah, I think, bless them, the people who framed this legislation did so from, if they'll forgive me for this, from a rather naive standpoint. I think they thought that they'd enact this legislation and somebody would ring and say, if you go to the top left-hand corner of such and such a field, you will find a grave. And to some degree that happened, in that 3 victims were recovered in those early days, the 1999-2000s. One was left in a disused graveyard, and a local priest was informed. So clearly that had been on private ground somewhere and was exhumed by the former paramilitaries, put in a coffin and left there. 2 more were found by the guards. And there was another case where a body was found on a beach by accident. But other than that, all these other cases were left as big question marks.
When you first came over, did you realise how big and sensitive of a job this was going to be?
No, I think that's...
Yeah.
I think that's a fairly straight answer.
Yeah.
No. When I first arrived, I was asked if I would undertake a review and make recommendations on how the process could be taken forward. There was a guy called Mitchell Reese, who was one of the US officials, and he had done some work in the States where some railway workers who died and buried were found as a result of using forensic science.
They were actually Irish migrant workers.
Yeah. So he talked to the families and then wrote to the governments and said, you know, there are avenues you could explore here. So I think that's really, long story short, that's how... my name came into the frame. And, you know, really what we're doing is transforming this process from a reactive one where somebody's just sitting there waiting for the phone to ring, to a proactive one where we go and actually search and look for people who will help.
Yeah.
And evidence, obviously.
You were saying there sometimes you'd wait to get information through a phone call, or sometimes you'd be thinking to go out and try and get information yourself.
Yeah.
Was it ever hard to get people to trust you when you were going out looking for information?
I think, clearly it was in the early days. We had negotiations with the Republican movement right from my, certainly from my earliest involvement in 2005. And they agreed to come on board. I think persuading the primary people, the primaries if you want, for want of a better description, was not that straightforward. And some over the years have said, yes, I'm happy to talk to the commission. Others haven't. But I think it's clear that from the year dot, from our involvement, and I'm talking about the commission staff, from 2005, 2006 onwards, nobody has ever been arrested or prosecuted or convicted, for that matter, on information that's been passed to the commission. So it's a very small, very tight-knit group, and the information we receive is absolutely copper-bottom privileged. You know, it doesn't go anywhere. And it is used wholly and solely to recover and repatriate, no questions asked. So I think the answer to your question is, yeah, we're trusted more now than we ever were perhaps in the early days where, you know, people a bunch of English cops.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, yeah.
Ex-cops, what do we tell them, you know?
Yeah. Was there ever a time when you were doing a search and you were thinking about giving up and then you got the body?
No. I mean, the commission work continues to this day, and everybody who's involved in it is totally committed to trying to recover the outstanding cases, trying to resolve the outstanding cases. That work goes on, and I don't see that I don't see that changing anytime soon.
So, Jeff, do you know, or can you remember, who the first body recovered was under your watch?
Yeah, the first body we recovered was a guy called Danny McElhone, and he was killed at Ballinulta, just down the road here in County Wicklow. And his remains have been buried on a hillside just above a tributary of the Liffey. So
it was really close when you think about it.
Yeah.
But that's probably more fascinating to people who will listen to this, because they'll realise how close to home that actually was, because I think there's a separation, especially with us growing up, that people think like, oh, that was going on up north. Didn't really impact down here, even though it's only an hour away.
Yeah.
But a lot of people are oblivious to what was going on.
Yeah, but like that's basically down the road, this activity was going on.
I think that's true, yeah. I think it's not appropriate to go into the great detail, safe to say that this guy was kept as a prisoner down here, and I think he escaped, and that's why he was killed here. He wouldn't necessarily have been killed here. I don't know. I mean, I can't look into what.
Yeah.
What would have happened, what might have happened, but he was a prisoner and he was shot trying to escape.
What year was his body recovered?
2008, in November 2008. So we started in 2006. So it was just getting on for 2 years before we found one of the remains. We'd done a lot of work other than that one
in the intervening
period, of course.
Yeah. And so you said that like your aim was to have a more proactive approach. So
absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So when you start showing success and those bodies being recovered, does it flip then and do you start receiving more tip-offs? Does that like kind of inspire people to be like, this is actually better, we should help these people?
I think it was a gradual process. The INLA had murdered Seamus Ruddy in Rouen, in France. And they were really on board from the earliest stages as well. They were absolutely committed to us recovering Seamus's remains. But again, this issue of, well, whereabouts was it? And I think, you know, people's perceptions change over the years. People's memories play tricks on them. And I think we're all guilty of this, you know. I mean, I can go back to Saddleworth Moor now from my time searching in 1986-87 and think, where on earth were we? That's just the way it is. So, you know, I think going back and finding the exact spot is always going to be difficult. And we've never encountered anybody intentionally trying to deceive us, which is remarkable, really. The information we've been passed, albeit it was wrong, has clearly been well-intentioned.
Yeah.
And we thought we'd get a lot of bogus, intentionally misleading information, and we never have, which is remarkable, and a tribute to the guys who are helping over the years, or have helped over the years, you know.
Yeah, it kind of just epitomises what you were saying there earlier on, though, that this isn't a criminal approach, it's a humanitarian approach.
Absolutely, yeah. This is about helping the families.
Yeah.
It's a compromise, really, on their part, because they've come to the commission and asked the commission to search. They're not going to get any. They're not going to get any judicial, if you want, or criminal convictions for their cases, but they have had their loved ones returned to them, and they've got this. I know we talk about closure; it's an easy word to say, and it means so much, really. But they are getting closure. They can bury their loved one in the family grave. You know, they can go and grieve.
What was it like meeting the families after a body was recovered?
It's a very difficult, very, very difficult process. I think we have always ensured that whatever, and this was the rule, a ground rule really that I set when I got involved, that families would never hear about anything the commission was doing from a source other than the commission in the first instance. So I didn't ever want the commission, the families, to pick up a newspaper or hear it on the radio or see it on television that we were looking for their missing loved one. You know, we always made sure they were on board. My colleague of the day, John Hill, was appointed as the family liaison officer. So he kept in constant touch with the families. Everything we did in their case, they knew about beforehand. So I think no surprises for them, other than obviously eventually finding their loved ones. And I guess it's double-sided, really. You've got this two sides of a coin where you've got this great elation and closure at having found and returned their loved one to them. But obviously, it's confirmation that this individual was murdered and secretly buried and had been hidden for 20, 30 plus years, you know.
What sort of emotional toll does that take on you and your team? Like, surely that has to take its toll on you as going and letting a family know that.
There was an air disaster at Manchester Airport in 1985, I think it was, where an aircraft, a 737, was taking off and one of the engines blew up and it caught fire. And 50-odd people were sadly burned in the what was a fireball, really. It was an appalling case. So I was involved in that. And after that happened, it was the first time I'd ever heard of counselling. And somebody with a bit of foresight, because they were such traumatic events, it was a traumatic event, and the circumstances were traumatic.
Yeah.
They laid on counselling for us all afterwards. And I can always remember this. We were in these little syndicates of half a dozen people with a counsellor. And I can always remember this lady saying, you know, she went round and said, has this affected you? Has this affected you? And so on and so forth. And some did and some didn't. But she said to me, and it's a very simple solution, I suppose. She said, it's about putting your life in boxes. And so, you know, what you've got to do is really, I mean, you hear this thing about, well, you can leave it at work. Well, that's exactly what she was saying, that you put this stuff in a box and you don't let it, try not to let it affect the rest of your life. And so I guess I took that on board in 1986, albeit I'd seen stuff before that as well. And I've tried to keep that in my mind. So it's an oversimplification, clearly, of how these things work. But I think being able to say, well, that is a process that I leave there. And when I close the door on it, I will leave it until the door opens again, as opposed to taking it home and having sleepless nights thinking about all this. Because if you let this just accumulate, it would send you nuts, really. Because they're appalling. They're horrific events and horrific crimes.
Yeah. So 2008 is when you found the first body under your watch, Jeff. Are you starting to see kind of, because I'm trying to picture what has changed from when you went back to say to the Moore murders. So that's in the 80s.
Yeah.
You're talking 20 years later, 25 years, even 30 years actually. But are you seeing techniques and science has changed and you're able to cover more ground, you're able to search more efficiently? Is that kind of, would you attribute that to the successes we're finding as opposed to the proactive?
I think a mix of both, really.
Yeah.
In fairness, there have been no transformations from the 1980s to 2026. The technology has moved on, that's for sure. I mean, we were looking at ground-penetrating radar in the 1980s, and it was a great lumbering process and very slow and very painstaking. It's far more advanced now, because this came primarily from the military looking for non-metallic ordnance, you know, plastic landmines and the like, and the oil industry, where they're doing survey work as well. So these technologies certainly have developed, not because of what we've done, but because of what others have done. You know, canine search, cadaver search, that process has been developed and is developing now, where where we in the 1980s we would just let a dog and dog handler roam around aimlessly. You know, it is now contained. It is precise. You know, we operate on 20. I say we, the commission, operate on 20 by 20 meter grids, and lines run across that so that at 1 meter apart. So the dog is searching. You know, there are probe holes every meter. And the dog is searching carefully. Now there may be multiple dogs, so you're not just relying on one dog that might be having a bad day. You know, I mean, that's an important aspect of all this.
Yeah.
The other thing is that canine search, which is probably as good as it gets, I think, in terms of, you know, if you talk to people, they say that the dog scenting is better than any machine. And I think that's true, but the dog has got to know what it's looking for. And you've got to get a dog. I mean, I repeat just what I said a few months ago. You've got to get a dog on a good day.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want the dog having a bad hair day. So I think what's happening now is that in the early days, the dogs were responding to the active scent of decay. When you end up with just skeletal remains, what's there for the dog? And so they're now talking about training dogs to look for bone, the scent of bone decay, which apparently can be different from soft tissue decay.
Yeah.
So these are the processes that are developing and changing over the years.
Jeff, there's four bodies unrecovered.
Yeah.
Do they haunt you, or are they at peace with what you've done?
I think frustrated is probably a better term.
Yeah.
Because we know so much about them, but we know so little about them. And we don't know where they are. The case of Columba McVeigh, for example, who's buried just north of Monaghan town, in a peat bog north of Monaghan, called Braggan. We are absolutely satisfied that the people who were involved in this have told us what happened and told us where he was buried. The commission has, over the years, searched 26 acres or more of Braggan bog and not found Columba McVeigh. Something's wrong. Something is not right. Because had he been there, we'd have found him by now.
Yeah.
I'm as sure as I can be. I believe these guys absolutely that he was buried there. Well, why is he not there now? We honestly don't know, and they don't know either. You know, has somebody perhaps been digging peat there? Because there are peat banks all over the place there. Has somebody been digging peat and thought, oh, I don't want this on my peat bank. I'll shift it. If it's gone to the other side of a track, well, it might as well be 100 miles away, not 100 yards away. You know.
Who are the other three, Jeff, just so we have the names?
Yeah, Columba McVeigh, Robert Narak, Captain Narak, Seamus Maguire, and Joe Linsky. So they're all missing, and they've all been the subject of intense inquiries over the years, but not resolved.
What do they need to do to recover them?
Well, I obviously appeal to anybody, and I would hope that you put the commission's contact details on the back end of anything in due course, so people know where to get hold of the commission with information. The problem is that the people who were involved in this are now elderly or sadly passed away. They have clearly told people in some cases, not all of them, they've clearly told people, and we would ask those people to pass on that information, because it's the best we've got now anyway. It could be the best we've got now anyway. I mean, some guys who were involved in paramilitarism in the 1970s say they could be pillars of society, and their, you know, or their families know nothing about what they did as young men. We would ask them to, you know, do a bit of soul searching, please. And if you know anything, do come forward. We won't disclose to anybody, including families. If you have information that you feel is of relevance, please, please do pass it on to us. It could be the difference between not finding somebody and finding somebody. I think that last but not least, the case of Robert Narak, who was a British soldier who was murdered and buried in Ravensdale, just south of the border. His name has been associated with all sorts of murder and mayhem and what have you. We are absolutely 100% satisfied that he was not involved in any of this stuff. A lot of the allegations that have been made against him have surfaced in books and films and what have you. And it's not been helped by the British Ministry of Defence, who, whenever they're questioned, say, we will neither confirm nor deny, you know, which is their stock response to everything. And it's grossly, grossly unfair
yeah.
to his family, because their records prove beyond any reasonable doubt that Robert Narak was... He wasn't even in Ireland when the majority of these... I think there are five cases. Four of those cases, he wasn't even in Ireland when these events occurred. And the fifth one, he was involved in an operation in Derry. And the case, the event took place in County Monaghan. Mm. So, you know, we can prove beyond any reasonable doubt he couldn't possibly have done it. Mm. But of course, this stuff, because the Ministry of Defence has not said, all they have to do is say, well, we neither confirm nor deny in cases such as this. However, we can confirm that Robert Narak wasn't in Ireland at the time or whatever. They should have done that 20 years ago and we wouldn't be where we are now.
Yeah, and as you said, like, that's a frustrating thing there, because like, these are government ministries. They have resources that could actually help, and the least thing you're looking for is just some confirmation. You're not actually yeah. looking for them to send in that's people right. or whatever. That's it's right. just one thing you're looking for yeah. there. What was the most recent discovery you've had? What year was it?
Seamus Ruddy.
In 2018, I think that was.
I think it was 2017, was it? I can tell you if you bear with me 1 second.
Yeah.
Yeah, 2017, May 17.
Yeah, so that's, you're talking 9 years ago now.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's mad to think. I think because I was listening to something about him, and I think he went missing in, like, was it the 80s?
He went missing in May 1985.
1985, and like, he was discovered then, what?
2017.
It 32 years later. Yeah.
That's right.
Like, I'm 32 now, so like, if you were to think about it, that's my whole lifetime a family have waited for that closure.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's awful. Crazy.
It's awful.
Yeah.
Jeff, we really appreciate you flying over and coming on the show and having this conversation. It's a real eye-opener.
It's a pleasure. It's been nice talking to you. I just repeat what I said before. If there's anybody out there who has any information whatsoever, however trivial they think it is or meaningless, please do get in touch.
Yeah.
And let us be the judges. You don't have to get in touch directly. There's an anonymous phone line recording, or go to somebody else and ask them to contact the commission on their behalf. We'd be delighted to hear from them.
We'll leave all the details in the description and we'll add them in as a tagline at the end. Yep. Jeff, you probably won't appreciate this, but we're looking forward to the book.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, no, thanks for having
us. If we ever get around to it.
Yeah, thanks, Siobhan.
Boom.
That's us for this week, and thanks to the legends at Roystyle Furniture for supporting the podcast.
Speaking of great support, see what I did there? Roystyle has everything, and I mean everything. Sofa sorted, beds covered, dining table, 6 chairs, boom. All in one house package. Plus the lads in the store are sound. They're not pushy, just helpful. And if you're an online shopper, no problem.
Visit www.roystyle.ie, and when you shop in store, tell them that the two boys from the podcast sent you, and they'll throw you in a little discount.
Don't sleep on this deal, unless it's on one of their mattresses, in which case, fair play.
So get down and get the gaff sorted. Right price, right style, right now.
Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app. What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your whip in it now. Fill your body up in. Walk it hard and low. When you finish that. The hip knocker. Go down, go down, go down, go down.